supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. When children are exposed to domestic violence, the trajectory of their lives can be altered forever. As much as we'd like to think doesn't happen very often, 5 million children each year are exposed in some way to violence in the home. Admittedly, this is uncomfortable for all of us, which is why so much of this never gets talked about. Well, on today's show, we're going to be referencing a documentary called The Children Next Door, which really takes an unflinching look at a family brutalized by violence and their movement towards recovery. We're fortunate to be joined by the director of the movie, Doug Block, and its executive producer, Brian Martin. Doug and Brian, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Good to be here.
We're also joined here in the studio by Julie Campbell. She's the coordinator of trauma-focused projects at the Children's Crisis Treatment Center here in Philadelphia. Julie, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be taking your calls later in the show. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking about the impact of domestic violence on children. And it's worth mentioning right here at the top of the show, this discussion may not be appropriate for all listeners. Brian, let's start with you here. You said that when you were 7 years old, you decided you wanted to do something about children who were exposed to domestic violence. What did you understand when you were seven about what was happening in your family, and specifically to you, Brian?
Well, it's just something that, you know, at the time, you could never know how many people are experiencing it, because your numbers are correct, right? There are about 5 million children in this country alone, about 275 million children globally, and there are about 40 million adults living here today amongst us, you know, in the States, who were children of domestic violence. And at the time, you know, when you're young, you can never understand. It seems as though you're the only one going through it. And, you know, I remember how much it hurt, you know, how difficult it was to see what I saw, to experience what I experienced, to not be able to stop it, to in some illusionary way believe it was somehow either my fault or that I should be able to stop it, or, you know, to believe that maybe I'm less than, or, you know, that my life is just going to turn out very differently because I'm growing up in this home.
What did you see, and at what age?
You know, our home was not uncommon as it relates to the millions of households in this country and globally. You know, the first memories that you have are of memories of the people that you love the most in your life. You know, as a child, you really have two people. You have mother and father, or man, woman, however that is, maybe mother, boyfriend, father, girlfriend. And I mean, those two people are really your entire life. And when you see them hurting one another, and you're not able to stop it, and sometimes you get hurt too, because in about half of these homes, the children that grow up in them also get involved in the physical violence somehow. Sometimes they're targeted because the adults just snap. Sometimes they're not targeted. Sometimes they're just part of what winds up happening in the house. But it's these people that, you know, you care about so much that are hurting one another, and you just, it happens night after night. You never know when it's going to happen. The anticipation is almost worse than when it occurs.
Brian, let me turn to you, Doug. The documentary we're talking about here, The Children Next Door, tells the story of a mother and her four children as they try to steady themselves 5.5 years after a horrific event. On the night One night in 2006, a mother, Penny, is brutally attacked by her violence-prone husband, Brad. That same night, Brad kills Penny's best friend, and all of this unfolds in front of the children. And by the way, Brad was hacking Penny with a machete. So tell us about the film and why you wanted to make it in the first place.
Well, what's interesting for me is I was hired on by the producer, Linda Hansen, and I came to the film not as an advocate for children of domestic violence, but someone who is actually quite ignorant about the whole situation. You know, I'm primarily a documentary filmmaker who tries to tell good stories, and usually about issues that are important but tend to be in the background. And so I was focused first and foremost on this story of this family and the children and how, you know, as you said, 5.5 years later, they, you know, are still haunted by this event and how they're recovering from it. And it was really during the making of it that my eyes were opened to how prevalent domestic violence is and how much it impacts children. I mean, it's just mind-boggling when you think of the statistics. And, you know, I thought, for me, the challenge was how to tell a story where you see the kind of the human face behind the statistics, because as amazing as this one individual family story is, it's just one of, as Brian said, millions of stories.
Brian, tell us a bit more about the family you featured in the film.
Sure. The way that I met them, we have the fortune, the good fortune to work with some of the leading researchers in the world with respect to this issue. And one of them reached out to me very late one evening and sent me an email from the producers at CBS for the Dr. Phil show, where they were going to do a story about a family. And he sent me the questions, and, you know, I was looking at it, and we spoke later that day, or later the next day, and he asked my opinion of this, and I said, did the producers ask Penny and her husband whether they were themselves children of domestic violence? Because so frequently, as was the case with my mother and grandmother and grandfather and generations back, you know, many repeat what they learn, as odd as that sounds. And I asked them that question, you know, did Penny and Brad, you know, did they just repeat what they saw and experienced growing up? And after I mentioned that to him, I think he mentioned it to the producers, and the producers said they wanted to talk to me more about that, and then they wound up having me on the show, which is where I first met the family, and that's how we met.
Oh, that's where you first met them. Well, I want to bring in a clip here of this family. Now, we'll hear from 15-year-old, who was 15 at the time, Chelsea. She's the oldest of the four children. She shares her feelings about her father, who remains in prison for his crimes. Now, at the time, she hadn't seen him for nearly 6 years. She had been very close to him, and she wants to visit him. Her mother is against the visitation. Here's Chelsea speaking.
I talk to everybody, you know, but I don't get close to anybody. I still love my dad, and that's what people don't understand. Like, if you were to tell society, hey, I love my dad even though he murdered my mom's best friend and almost killed my mom, they look at you like you're crazy. They just know about this horrible monster that committed a horrific incident or whatever. And me, I know this dude that was like my hero, my best friend, you know, my dad.
This whole story really is about relationships, isn't it, Doug?
Yeah. And for me, the really fascinating relationship was with the mother, Penny, and Chelsea, the oldest of the four children, who I believe was actually 10 at the time of the incident, and was always a daddy's girl. In fact, she even flat out says that I loved my dad and I hated my mom. And because Brad had, you know, in a sense, brainwashed her and the other children against the mother while she was out working in the factory. He would claim that she was out partying with friends, and it was all very confusing to them. You know, I think what's remarkable about the film is that we were able to capture in quite a short period of time a remarkable transformation in the relationship between Penny and Chelsea.
Yeah, I want to hear details of that and how it unfolded. This might be a perfect time to bring Julie Campbell in, who's the, like I said, coordinator of a trauma-focused project at the Children's Crisis Treatment Center. Julie, first of all, it does seem illogical that Chelsea would still love and want to see her father after she witnessed him almost hack her mother to death, kill her mother's best friend right before her eyes, and here, 6 years after witnessing that, she still loves her dad and wants to see him.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key confusing things that happens for kids around domestic violence is the ambivalence, and it can be really hard for people around them. Like Chelsea talked about, people saw him as a monster, but she has this other relationship with him. And most people who lose control of their anger in violent ways aren't 100% in the monster mold. There are times when they're positive and loving, so there's a tremendous amount of ambivalence and mixed feelings that can be really hard for people around a child to understand.
So I wonder what the impact of that is. I mean, you still love a man who did monstrous things. How do you live with that?
Creates a lot of confusion. A lot of confusion about, is something wrong with me that I still love him? Is there something wrong with my mother that she can't forgive him? So for the child, a lot of confusion and isolation around their own feelings and wondering, is something wrong with me? Am I normal? And of course, how they carry those feelings and confuse messages into other relationships.
You know, Julie, 3 years ago, there was an article written in the Juvenile Justice Bulletin, and it reviewed a national survey of children's exposure to violence. It measured the impact from birth to 17, and what they found was astounding to me. They found 60% of the children surveyed were exposed to violence within the past year, either directly or indirectly. In some cases, they witnessed a violent act or learned of a violent act against a family member, neighbor, or close friends, or experienced a threat at home or school. These numbers are astounding. And can all of these things affect the trajectory of a child's life?
Absolutely, because the message is anger equals violence, and the person who's violent has control and has power. I mean, look at the family dynamic in the film. I mean, who has the power in that situation was the dad.
You know, traditional thinking is if a child watches a violent act, they're at least better off than being part of it or a victim of violence. Not true, huh?
Well, to many degrees, being helpless and having that anticipatory anxiety can create a lot more stress because there's no control.
You know, the survey I mentioned, nearly a third of all of those children, 14 to 7-year-olds, had seen a parent assaulted. And as I read on, nearly one-third of those children will either be a perpetrator or a victim of domestic violence. Now, we know the statistics. Tell me what goes on inside the minds and hearts of those children. And again, it's not logical when we just look at our prefrontal cortex that we would repeat something horrible that we lived through. So what How does that work?
Well, we all rely on what's familiar to us. And so when children are raised around violence, you know, their role models are the adults around them. And children rely on adults to keep them safe. So when the adults are out of control and they're not safe with each other, children can really feel helpless. And then again, the messages are, and sometimes what we see in the children we treat who've been exposed to domestic violence is right along gender lines. So if mom was a victim, then the girl may be passive and may be a victim in lots of ways in her own life. Boys may be more aggressive, or girls can also become aggressive. So what happens is that there's so much confusion and a lot of unhealthy negative coping skills. So kids really need a lot of support around what we call cognitive distortions around what happened. You know, their belief about whose fault it was. Sometimes children believe it's the police's fault when police come and arrest dad, especially very, very young children. So the impact on children really depends on the child's age and level of development and how long the exposure to domestic violence is.
Well, Julie and Doug and Brian, I just found out that we've got Chelsea on the line with us. And Chelsea was the young lady featured in that in that last clip. Chelsea, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Julie, tell us how you are.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, and I'm very, very happy to hear your voice. I don't know if you heard that clip we played from the documentary about wanting to visit your dad in prison. Now, the documentary, this took place 2 years ago, yes?
Yes.
So you're what, 17 years old now?
Yes, I'm 17.
Is your dad still in prison?
Yes, he is.
Tell me your feelings about your dad, your relationship with him today.
We don't have a relationship, but I'm not bitter towards him anymore. I've grown past that. I feel like if I hold a grudge against him, then I'm not letting myself reach my full potential.
How did you go from 10-year-old Chelsea, who had to bear witness to these horrific things, to where you are now, letting go of holding a grudge on your dad? What was that process like?
It was a long process, but, I mean, once I realized the truth about domestic violence and the cycle of it, then, I mean, I naturally overcame it.
What is the truth that
you learned? The truth is, no matter what you go through, once you realize that it can't be held against you, you can become anything you want to be. Your past does not determine your future.
So what does your future look like, young lady? You're in high school now?
Yes, I'm a senior in high school. So my future is anything I want it to be. I mean, I can honestly go wherever I decide to go.
So where do you want to go?
I'm looking towards law school, but I'm not quite sure yet.
Chelsea mentioned she wanted to be governor when we were shooting.
Who's this, Doug? Is this Doug?
Hi, Chelsea.
Hey, how are you?
Real good.
So, Chelsea, tell us about your relationship with your mom, and I want to know how you've got two younger sisters and a younger brother. I want to know how everybody's doing.
Well, me and my mom, I mean, as you heard from the clip and from what Doug said, me and my mom has had a long road, but we're at a point now where I see her for who she is, and she's a very strong, independent woman, and she's had to go through so much. Like, she's my hero. I honestly look up to her. And my brothers and sisters and I, we're all doing great.
That's so good to hear. And what do you attribute that to? Were you guys in therapy?
Actually, no, we're not in therapy. But the documentary really helped us out, because before we did not talk about what happened. But by putting our lives out there, we had to overcome things that we kept in the closet. It really brought a lot to all the issues we were having.
Yeah, you know, I always feel that, honey, when you keep things in the dark, they fester. You know, it grows mold in there when you keep it in the dark. And I'm so glad the door opened up for you and you got some sunlight in there. I know you've got to get to class. I don't want to be responsible for making you late for class because then I'll feel terrible. And we've got to take a break. Chels, thanks so much for joining us. And on behalf of everyone who sees this documentary, thank you for doing it. And everybody listening is wishing the best for you.
Well, thank you.
Take good care of you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Like I said, we've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking more about the documentary. Doug Block and Brian Martin will stay with us. They're the director and executive producer of The Children Next Door. And Julie Campbell will be here. We're going to talk more about what goes on inside and what can be done for reparation. Julie is a licensed clinical social worker and coordinator of the trauma-focused projects at Children's Crisis Treatment Center here in Philadelphia. Well, our phone number is 888-477-9499. We'll be taking your calls in the second half of the show. Again, 888-477-9499. If you or a loved one has been exposed to domestic violence, or if you're a mental health professional and deals with children exposed to domestic violence, give us a call. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them take control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2, or online at iamconcerned.org. Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
I believe they both thought that they could change. Both grew up in abusive homes. Then they got together and they were like, okay, we're going to change this. We're going to be the ones to break the cycle. But then they never got help. They never got better.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about children exposed to domestic violence. And you just heard the voice again of at the time, 15-year-old Chelsea, and she, her siblings, and mother depicted in this documentary. This is a family that is reeling after being exposed to domestic violence over the course of years. Julie, I want to follow up with you. First of all, tell us. Julie seems to have a well-thought-out understanding. We heard it in the first part of our show about, you know, her mother and her father's relationship. She sounds pretty grounded at this, you know, and at peace with her history. It's kind of amazing to me that a young girl, woman, 17 years old, can be at this point after seeing what she saw at age 10. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think Chelsea has a level of emotional wisdom based on her trauma experiences. There's sort of a level of emotional intelligence that children sometimes develop when they're exposed to any kind of trauma. They have to try to make sense of what happened. And, you know, she certainly articulated it well in terms of her parents' struggle.
Well, that's the case with any of us. when we go through trauma, we do have to make sense of it somehow, find some meaning in it. And perhaps that's why, and I want to turn to you, Brian, that's why perhaps she said the documentary was so helpful for her.
Well, the thing that the, and she, you can hear it in her voice, right? She's remarkable, and so are her whole family is. And, the data is very clear in this area. And when we ask the leading experts in the world, what is the one thing that causes a young person to grow up in a home such as this but lead to the path of resiliency? And they all agree that there's one factor. And the one factor is this, that an adult steps in to help them see the truths that they can't see clearly for themselves. And as soon as they can see it, the brain literally can begin unlearning. It can begin unlearning the lies it knows to be true, and the brain can change. We know this is true. But an adult has to step in, and in an environment and a society globally where we have less than 10% awareness of this issue, where the parents certainly aren't comfortable talking about it, many of which are just repeating the cycle, who's going to talk about it, right? How does a child open up, and how does an adult open up the dialogue with a child?
Hey, Brian,
it's very, very challenging.
Tell us about,
and it goes on to adulthood.
Tell us about 7-year-old Brian. Who was the adult in your life that helped you talk about it?
There wasn't one. I didn't. There wasn't one. There wasn't one until I was about 29, and that just came up from a random conversation that I had with a stranger that I met on a plane. But there were a few things that helped me along the way, and they were, just a couple of books that people gave me. My mother gave me a book when I was 18. A guidance counselor gave me a book when I was 18. And those books, if you will, in essence, became the adult who stepped in for me. They didn't tell me the truth that I needed to know, but they certainly did make it clear that you can go through very challenging things in life, and if you can overcome them, what can't you overcome? So when you start reading about other adults, maybe they didn't grow up in one of these homes, but they certainly have overcome great things. I said to myself, geez, if they can get past that, I can certainly, get out of this house. But it did not occur to me until I was much older that growing up in that home actually had any impact whatsoever on who I became as an adult.
Ah, that's interesting. Julie, when Brian was talking, he used the word resilient, and he said that's one thing everyone has in common, and that's been my personal experience when I do all my informal interviews with people who have overcome great adversity. They always say a variant on, there was one adult who was there right when I needed it. But broaden that picture out a little bit for us, Julie, if you would. It's like, who is more likely to be resilient? What are the factors that go into that?
Well, we talk about recovery environment, and I think the way he just described having one adult. So what we know about children who've been exposed to any kind of trauma is that healing happens in a good recovery environment, and that can include a helpful, supportive neighbor, teachers, friendships, siblings, a child who has strengths and is good at something. Maybe it's sports, maybe it's chess, maybe it's something in the arts. So resiliency factors are a number of pieces and a number of determinants related to a child's environment and in their day-to-day lives where they're given support for the strengths. And in adults who've been victimized or exposed to trauma as children will also talk about something internal, an internal belief they had that this wasn't the way their life was always going to be and that it wasn't their fault. And it's sort of like holding on. Some adults will talk about, I just knew I had to hold on because then I could find a different path.
Yeah, I recall now that you mentioned it, Julie, years ago, I interviewed a man. Both his parents had schizophrenia. He was an only child, and both his parents had schizophrenia. So they were hallucinating in the house. One parent would go in the hospital, and then the other one would, sometimes both. And I said to him, how did you survive? He said, well, at one point I was a little boy, and at one point I realized both my parents were seriously disturbed. So that's that internal kind of vision, to be able to take a look at the big picture. So despite all this, despite all this support that children may or may not get, many of these children have difficulties with attachment and anxiety and depression and so on and so forth. What can be done?
Well, certainly if children can get into treatment, and, you know, obviously the documentary was so helpful to this family and it really was their form of therapy. But children and families, you know, regardless of the child's age, even very, very young children can benefit from treatment. And therapy is so useful because it's a neutral place where children can talk about or play about what they've been exposed to and really get their feelings out and gain some level of mastery.
These families and children need, when they're in therapy, they need to be with a therapist who's trained in trauma.
Yes, trauma-focused therapy.
Because they need to be in good therapy because there is bad therapy.
Well, trauma therapy is really a specialization. It's like any other, you know.
So what do we look for when we want to find a trauma therapist?
So we look for a therapist or a program that really identifies itself as specialized in providing trauma-focused treatment and using best practices.
What are they? What do you do?
Well, we use a treatment approach in our trauma department at CCTC that's really based on, you know, taking the key components, the best practices from several different models. So there are components of cognitive behavioral therapy I mentioned earlier, helping children with cognitive distortions. There's some wonderful tools in that approach to therapy where children are helped to create a trauma narrative, where they write the story or they show the story in a dollhouse or through pictures about what they've been exposed to. And the therapist can then help the child look at their thoughts and feelings at each step in their story. And there we look for, what are they internalizing as their fault, and who are they blaming? And then we can try to help to correct some of those distortions. So there are lots of components that we use, and again, it depends on the age of the child. So very young children, even as young as 18 months, can benefit from child-parent psychotherapy, which is a model designed for a very young child exposed to trauma and their caregiver that's focused on attachment and bonding and helping the caregiver understand some of the behaviors in a young child that may be confusing to them after trauma.
You said 18 months, and you know, traditional thinking was that children 18 months younger than 18 months didn't have an impact because they didn't know what they were seeing. But now we know it actually affects their brain development.
Absolutely. We've learned so much about how the brain is affected, and very young children are affected by exposure to trauma.
Doug, let's get back to this family. And we know the documentary itself began to help them, but how did you portray this process of their getting better? Do we have you, Doug?
I think we just went down. We went down for three different shoots of 3 days each down to Tennessee. And, you know, as I said before, we were quite lucky to get to be able to capture this quite remarkable transformation in the relationship between Chelsea and Penny. And yes, I think they did have documentary therapy to an extent, just by, you know, having us listen to them and hear their stories and hear about their experiences, you know, and sit down with all of the children and with Penny, you know, and individually interview them. And I think giving them the opportunity to express their feelings was very big for them. I also think, you know, he's a little too modest to say, but I think Brian was also the one adult that was there for them as well, and particularly for Chelsea, and who saw this real potential in Chelsea to be a spokesperson and speak as a child of domestic violence on the issue. And you can see she's amazing.
Yeah, and it's really empowering to her. I mean, one thing that any trauma does to anybody is it disempowers them. And you know, to do this for this family and Chelsea in particular is really empowering. The other thing I wanted to mention before we take our break is, you know, the greatest gift you can give someone is to look in their eyes and say four words: tell me your story. And if you can do that with someone, then you know, you could wind up being that person to change someone's life. You don't have to fix anything. You just have to listen to their story, and it's just those four words.
Yeah, I think it was absolutely, and I think it was really important for the children to hear that we didn't go down there with any set agenda. We didn't have a treatment or a script in any way. We just went down wanting to hear what they had to say and what their perspective on the incident was, and how, you know, and just try and capture how they were trying to get beyond it.
Well, we've got to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk about so much more, and we've got another clip of Chelsea. I want to be able to hear her voice a little more. But we're talking about children exposed to domestic violence with Julie Campbell, social worker with the Children's Crisis Treatment Center in Philadelphia. Doug Black and Brian Martin are the director and executive producer of the wonderful documentary, The Children Next Door. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, supports WHYY and is accepting clients at their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute has served the region since 1994 by providing treatment for psychological challenges, including depression, anxiety, and stress. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about children exposed to domestic violence with social worker Julie Campbell and producer and director of the film The Children Next Door, Doug Block and Brian Martin. Julie, you know, a lot of the reasons that there is silence around this is because of shame.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what does it. That also seems illogical, doesn't it?
Yeah, sure it does. And I think for children, domestic violence happens in shame and secrecy. And even within the family, people then, after an event, after an incident, act like everything's fine. So the message the children get is we act like everything's fine and nobody talks about it. So that creates even more confusion, and children aren't really sure if they can even trust their own perceptions of what happened.
And, of course, then there's this grandiosity that Brian referred to earlier about children think they could have or should have done something about it. So you've got guilt on top of the shame.
Yes, and many children do try to intervene, and that creates even more confusion.
Even more violence, yes. Right. So let's hear one more clip from the documentary, The Children Next Door. Again, we hear from Chelsea, and here she's involved in a walkathon for survivors of domestic violence. She expresses her understanding here of the importance of speaking up. Let's listen.
Before we started doing anything with domestic violence, it was just that big elephant in the room. Like, it's something that we didn't talk about. We avoided it. And then finally, we decided to raise awareness and put ourselves out there, and when we did, it actually helped us understand what we went through.
That was Chelsea, one of the people featured in the documentary, The Children Next Door. I wonder, Brian, what about you? Who did you get to tell your story to, or is all this work, you know, your way of telling your story?
You know, I just thought that there would be, there's got to be a way to help, it's so many people. You know, it's just, the numbers are absolutely staggering when you study them. And I came upon a few pieces of data from UNICEF and other sources that the numbers of people who grew up in these homes, yet the awareness level of this issue is so low that, you know, how can we have so many people that have an experience in common but yet be ashamed or feel guilty about something that they couldn't possibly control, right? You don't get to choose what home you grow up in. That's where you go. That's it. It's not your doing. But yet these lies stick with us for so many years. They stuck with my grandmother, grandfather, mother, her boyfriend. And, you know, there just has to be something that can be done. And this insight of, well, a lot of people have an opinion about domestic violence, and we've seen all the study and data on that. They have a lot of opinions about domestic violence. A lot of them are very strong. When you begin to talk to them about, well, what about the children of domestic violence? What about the children who grow up in those homes and then grow to be adults? What about them? You know, do you pass judgment on them? And they don't. And you're able to see this issue through very different eyes. And I've seen people's opinion about this issue change dramatically when they think about it through the eyes of a child who then, you know, becomes an adult. Yet they've never gotten the help.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Aaron on the line. Hey, Aaron.
Hi, Dr. Gottlieb. I always try to be in my car when your show is on because I love everything you say.
Thank you.
I am a first-time caller. But the reason I'm calling is I worked with victims of domestic violence for a long time in a volunteer capacity, and we always worked with the women. And what we found was that it's very dangerous when women get up to leave. That's the most dangerous time for them. So for that reason and for a variety of other reasons, the option that women take, whether it's appropriate or not, is to stay in the relationships for whatever reasons they have. So how does a mother who feels she has to stay in the relationship help the child to understand that this isn't right and there's no shame on the child?
Yeah, you bring up a really important point. I want to turn to you, Julie. You know, this is a judgment-free zone, and some mothers, we know the ideal, but they truly feel they can't leave. So,
and for many mothers, just as the caller said, leaving would be more dangerous.
Well, and that's just what happened here.
Yes.
With this family, when she finally told him, that's when he got violent.
Right. Right, because domestic violence is about control, and the intimacy is based on control and power. So in terms of a child who's in a situation where there is ongoing domestic violence, I think communication is important. Children need to hear what may be obvious, that violence is not okay. Your dad has a problem with anger. He loses control when he's angry. So that children get the message that the perpetrator of the violence is the one accountable. And kids need help with safety planning, that it's not their job to intervene. They need to know how to call 911. They need to have numbers for relatives who can help them. And they need to know how to try to stay safe if something scary is happening. And, of course, we'd want for that family that safety becomes the first priority.
All right, you just ticked off a lot of things that family needs. How do they reach you? How does someone reach you at the Children's Crisis Treatment Center?
Well, I believe that I provided some resources in the area for help for domestic violence, and there's a domestic violence hotline in Philadelphia that is a gateway for women and men who are in domestically violent relationships to get support, to get guidance, because it's a very complicated thing and each situation is different.
Well, I should say we have that information on our webpage or will right after the show. So, you know, if this is going on in your family, please check out our webpage. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Christopher on the line.
Hello? Hello?
Christopher.
Yes, doctor. I wish I had called in earlier. I caught the end of the show. I'm a 64-year-old person, and I want to say that you never fully you never fully recover from domestic abuse. I was abused physically and psychologically as a child. I am, by all accounts, successful today, but it was a long process. As a 10-year-old, I watched my father slam my mother's head through a wall when he got angry, and she collapsed in a pool of blood on the floor in front of us. I had 7 siblings, and you never knew what was going to touch your father off. And when you did, when that powder keg was ignited, he would come at you and physically just pummel you into unconsciousness. And that went on until I became 12 years old and for the first time stood up to him and hit him back, which was very typical for me because I lived in a family where there was respect for the father, and I really loved my father. But he constantly told us that we were no good, we weren't going to account to anything, that we were disobeying children. And it was up to him to make sure that we stayed on the right path. But I never got help until I was 29 years old and went for therapy at my wife's request because I had fallen into alcoholism to self-medicate the memory of times. And when you said, tell me your story, you touched a chord in me, and I just had to call and get in there for a few seconds. I could do a whole show. But I even wrote a book called The Closer Song where I detail the type of abuse that I went through as a kid in part of the book.
Christopher, tell us how you are today and how you got there.
Today I am highly successful, but I still had moments when I remember the hurt and the pain of getting abused by someone I loved. And it was like, at one time, a kettle on the stove that was going to boil over. But every time I address it and talk about it, I lift the lid and let a little more steam out. And I'm so happy that you're talking about this subject, because when I was a kid, I thought every family was this way until I went over to my friend's house and saw what a loving family was really like. I couldn't believe it was true. Hmm. But I'm doing fine. I'm doing okay. It's manageable, but it never, ever will ever go away.
Well,
as a matter of fact, I rode from Philadelphia on my motorcycle to Yonkers, where my dad was buried one day, 100 miles, and I threw my helmet down on his grave, and I cried. I asked him why it had to be the way it was. And I forgave him, not for him, but for me,
So
that I could get over it. But I did one thing. A few years ago when we tried to reconcile, I sat with him, and he said, why are you so aloof and removed from me? I said, you never once told me you loved me. So I want you to go to my brothers and sisters and put your arms around them.
Christopher,
and I want you to tell each one of them that you love them.
Christopher, bless your heart. Bless your heart. What a wonderful contribution you have made to this show, to all of our listeners to the show. And boy, have you given us perspective. We wanted to talk about healing.
Thank you. It's nice to say that.
And nobody talks about healing as eloquently as you. Unfortunately, we have to move on. We've only got a couple more minutes to the show. Boy, I'd love to sit and talk with you for a couple hours one day. So thanks so much for calling. Brian, I want to follow that up with you. We've only got a couple of minutes left, but do you still have shadows? Like Christopher.
You know, it's not as much shadow. It's just, you know, we live in a world where there's lots of stimuli, so something you see or something you hear may trigger a thought that then triggers a feeling. And the key thing is to have it not trigger an action, or the key thing is to make sure you don't have to stay in that thought all the time. And when you realize, you know, what Christopher went through, or what anybody who grew up in one of these homes went through, when you compare that adversity and what he overcame, you know, it's no wonder that he mentioned a couple times that he's successful, right? Because he found in him that if he can overcome that obstacle, the obstacle of the child having to do what you do to get through that, you know, what can't you overcome when you're free from that environment and when you're an adult?
Doug, in just the last minute or so we have left, what impact has this work had on you After all, when you first started shooting this, you had no idea about children and domestic violence.
Yeah. like I said before, I just, you know, we read about the statistics all the time, or maybe not the extent of the statistics. We hear about domestic violence, but and it's just a very kind of abstract idea if you haven't really encountered it yourself. And the impact on me was really just getting to get involved in the lives of this family, where it was, you know, where they were so traumatized by it, and making and seeing what efforts they were doing to put it behind them and move on. And that's really what's so inspiring, I think, about the film, is that it doesn't wallow in the horror. It wallows in the aftermath and the attempt to get past the situation and move on to, you know, have really productive lives. And I think Chelsea is such a perfect example of what can happen.
Well, Brian, Doug, I want to tell you, there's a director here, you've done a great job at really portraying this family and portraying that arc. Unfortunately, we're out of time today. I really want to thank all three of you, Doug, Brian Martin, and Julie Campbell. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
And by the way, that number is 1-866-723-3014. That'll also be on our webpage. That's a hotline for domestic violence. Again, 866-723-3014. Next week on Voices, we'll be talking about the emotionally charged and charging landscape of family law. Well, we'd love to hear from you. We're at whyy.org/voices. You can download the show, listen to podcasts there, or comment. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And, of course, I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
You're listening to W.